Yeah, we're fine.
Oh, no, we're not.
Pam, are we ready? Okay, good afternoon, and welcome to the May 20th meeting of the Senate Committee on Commerce and Workforce Development. We have a very full agenda and a lot to get through today. We continued a bill that we did not have very many members left for, and so we're going to take that one up first, and we do expect a legislator to be joining us about another bill, and when he gets here, we'll briefly adjourn and then take his bill and then come back. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2831. There is a sign-up sheet back there. We also have a sign-up sheet that we did not complete the other day. So I think what I'll do is, for the moment, just till I get that other sign-up sheet, work off the one I've got in front of me. Dick Schwartz, are you here? Duke Shepherd, would you like to come forward? And we've got room for three. Mary Botkin, you do not wish to testify?
No, I'm with you.
Oh, we're waiting. Okay. Okay, so it looks like the two of you can come forward and, yeah, we'll just take you two for now. Oh, I'm sorry.
We got
and,
four.
Yeah, okay. I see, Melissa, did you already testify? Yes, okay.
Only one shot at this, right?
Okay, so whoever would like to go first, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Duke Shepherd with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I'll be brief because the folks here at the table are better experts at this than I. But I will just say we support the changes in collective bargaining law within House Bill 2831, and we sincerely hope that the committee and the Senate will consider the Dash 15s to deal with expedited bargaining, which I know you heard some from the other day from people with a great deal of expertise in it. I think it's best to just say that in some respects it's misnamed, at the very least, that the common understanding of bargaining isn't what happens when the outcome is essentially predetermined at the beginning. That it's good branding to call it expedited bargaining. We like to bargain and we like to do things fast, but in reality it's simply unilateral implementation with 90 days notice. Specifically, I'd like to touch on the supervisory issue, that it is the intent of this bill, the intent of our organization, that we would like to see the law restored to the status pre-Senate Bill 750 in 1995. And there was a great deal of case law before that was passed. I know the issue of relevant case law was raised in prior testimony. There were, I think, over 20 years of case law on the books dealing with the supervisory status issue pre-750. And while the law has changed, we can go back to the background and expertise that we had prior to that law. And I would just say the arguments for and against the supervisory issue are largely the ones you've heard on another bill for 2633, House Bill 2633. And the same procedural hurdles exist for unit clarification and changes in status. This is not something that is immediately going to impact thousands of upon thousands of workers. There are a number of procedural hurdles that have to happen for anyone's employment status to change. Finally, I would say that there was no revenue gain in 1995, so the supposition that there will be massive financial implications from adopting this now to return it to the pre-95 level is seems unlikely from our perspective. So with that, I will finish and hand it over to Dick. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And let me just remind you, if you have a cell phone or a BlackBerry or any such device, please turn it off. It does interfere with our recording system. And please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Richard Schwartz. I'm the Executive Director of the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. Among other public employees, we represent a substantial number of higher education and university faculty and teaching staff. Is it my voice?
Could be the cars that drive.
You know, you could be a little too close to the microphone, although it doesn't look like it.
No,
so.
I think it's
I think it is
interference.
Outside.
Yeah.
We got the shades up.
Yeah. We all just checked
them. Okay.
If we had the shades down, there's some type of filter that keeps all that from happening, but we're going to leave them up today.
Okay. Just keep going.
All right. Thank you. On behalf of AFT Oregon, I join with others in support of House Bill 2831 in general and in the amendments that are before you. You'll hear testimony on specific details from others about certain adjustments from the amendments that we think are for clarity and to avoid potential unintended consequences for existing representation status among some public employees. I want to address my remarks primarily to changes relating to the two-tiered double ballot provision for higher education faculty who are singled out in the current statute for a process unlike any other public employees covered by the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. And we support the change for deletion of that double ballot requirement. I have over 30 years' experience in representation and organizing under the Oregon Collective Bargaining Act, under the Collective Bargaining Acts of several other states in multiple regions of the National Labor Relations Board, and also under the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And in that experience, I can tell you this double ballot requirement is for a specific subgroup of public employees or any subgroup of employees is unique to this statute. Under the PECPA representation provisions or provisions for representation elections, each and every public employee who's covered by the Act is allowed and uses just a single ballot when there's a question of representation. The choices are either for representation or not, or if there's more than one choice on the ballot, it's whichever choice they make, or for no representation, which is always a choice on the ballot. Under the current statute, faculty in the University of Oregon, Oregon University system, are segregated and discriminatorily treated if they're working under the State Board of Higher Education for resolving those questions of representation. That implies that the most educated group of public employees is not able to respond to a single, simple choice question for representation. Even under the National Labor Relations Act, which covers private colleges and universities, there's only a single ballot question in representation elections for faculty. Segregating the university faculty requires five additional PECPA subsections and additional rules for special handling of that kind of ballot by the Employment Relations Board. And the current rules for just a single ballot for all other public employees has seemed sufficient for the tens of thousands who have exercised that right under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. I've tried to find out how that provision got in the statute in the first place, and nobody seems to know. There's nothing in any record that I can find in any discussion by the Employment Relations Board. Their role is just to implement that provision of the statute in the elections. So the problem with it is that with the two-part question, the first being, do you want to be represented for collective bargaining purposes, faculty employees could answer that in the no, for example, but could still go ahead and check a union on the second ballot. So you could have the outcome of employees not wanting collective bargaining, but a greater number selecting a particular organization, in which case the election would be invalid because they voted no on the first question. Some call this hedging their bets, and you can have other permutations of outcomes as well. With enactment of the majority sign-up in 2007 by the legislature, continuing the double ballot offers the potential for procedural disputes as well when and elect, for example, under the challenge election process, where a number of employees could seek an election when majority sign-up is requested through authorization cards. So university faculty are fairly educated and informed and sophisticated enough, we think, to handle a single question on a ballot, and that is a sufficient and efficient way to handle public employee collective bargaining elections involving faculty. Now, the questions have arisen, just so people, about what does this look like. So I've attached to my written testimony that I think you have in front of you examples from three different elections. The first one is for a unit of non-faculty at a community college. The second example is for a unit of faculty at a community college. In both cases, you'll see that's just a single ballot. And the third example is a double ballot question, two-question ballot that was used for a faculty representation election at Eastern Oregon University. That, I think, will help visualize help you visualize what exactly it is we're referring to, and where the single ballot has seemed to be sufficient for the many thousands who've exercised it. We think it's equally efficient and sufficient for faculty and higher education institutions. I just want to add a few additional remarks for some of the things that have been batted around in opposition to the bill and amendments. I think some of the speakers you heard referred to the current economic situation we're in as a reason to not make changes, particularly in the expedited bargaining process. I just want to help remind us all that since the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act was adopted in 1973, Oregon has had its share of economic crises, and it didn't seem to disrupt or the collective bargaining process or the need to make fixes when they were necessary to restore the rights that employees should enjoy as the act was originally envisioned. There's a lot of consternation about references to terms for casual and temporary. It should be kept in mind that in processing representation cases and in making determinations about the status of employees, none of those matters are disturbed. The Employment Relations Board still has to make a determination if there's a dispute whether an employee is, in fact, a public employee as contemplated under the statute, that its community of interest standards will still have to be examined and tested to make a determination whether a term like casual or temporary, while it's a term that has in-house definitions in multiple workplaces, every workplace has its own vernacular, is not necessarily the same as that might is that as that has been contemplated under the Collective Bargaining Act. So we have units, for example, where there are agreements between the union and the employer over what they define in that workplace under their contract as a temporary or casual and what exclusions there may be, but that's through the result of negotiations and not the technical definition. But whether or not those terms will apply as the amendments contemplate is still subject to case-by-case determination and application of the statute by the Employment Relations Board. Thanks, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I am going to have to ask people to be a little bit brief, and if you have written testimony, I promise we will read it, but we do have a lot of other bills as well as a lot of witnesses on this one. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I have the dubious honor of having been here in 1995 when the changes were made to PECPA. And, you know, it's very interesting when you listen to reinvented history by folks who were not in the building at the time. And I was struck by the fact that some of the witnesses at the last hearing talked about reversing longstanding case law. 750 didn't seem to even pause much when we suggested it was going to reverse longstanding case law of 20 years or better. And I would suggest that there's not enough case law built up at this point to be too concerned about it. This is what we want. We want to talk about everything at the bargaining table. We want to bargain over everything. When you talk about an economic crisis, there's nothing better than a good collective bargaining agreement to manage your way through that economic crisis. It provides for a organized, structured discussion between the employees and the employer, whether you're talking about furlough days or forced time off or whatever you need to talk about, budget cuts or budget expansions. The collective bargaining process gives you the opportunity to have a reasoned, cautious discussion with the employer and the employees, and in a good working environment creates much less of the us and them and creates an environment where people can come to reasonable decisions and conclusions about how to manage that crisis. The things that are important to us in this bill are the expedited bargaining, and we think that's very important. We believe that striker replacement is imperative. The taking out kind of unilaterally of election workers ignores several of our collective bargaining agreements where election workers are specifically included in the collective bargaining process, so that election workers, even when they're just brought in for a few months during an election cycle, do not get hammered or exploited in that process. The 600 hours is a problem for us that the counties are proposing, and we'll let SEIU talk to that. And the supervisory employees, we can sort of live with the language that you have before you. It's certainly not the language we would have preferred, but it is the language that we understand will help the bill move forward, and we're okay with that.
Mary, I think Senator Montes Anderson has a question for you, as well as I see Senator Bates is here to talk about the other bills. So.
Okay, and I will just sort of close and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to know how many times, it would be nice to know, especially from my district, how many times, say, Gresham-Barlow School District, Reynolds, Centennial, the City of Gresham used expedited bargaining or the college, and what actually covered. I mean, I've heard of two instances that I felt was inappropriately misused, one in Wilhelmina and the other, forget what the other one, Glasgow and I. Very inappropriate. But I would think that maybe there would be some circumstances where it would be very valuable. And I think that's the kind of information, the specifics. I need specific information.
Madam Chair, I do not have that information available at this moment, but I will do what I need to do to get it for you and talk to those principals who were involved in that. And I would be happy to respond as soon as I get it.
Thank you.
And as you know, we had a protracted labor dispute in your district just this last, how long ago? Within the last 24 months. I know it was really, really cold. And
or hot.
No, in this case, it was very, very cold. It reminded me that we do have an east wind in Portland. But I will find out about that. And I think the only other thing I want to say about expedited bargaining is I think it sort of ignores some of the changes in the bargaining process that many of us have gone to. For example, at OHSU, we use what's called collaborative bargaining, which means we simply never stop bargaining. You just sort of keep bargaining on and on and on. And expedited bargaining, when I was still a staff rep and doing bargaining, we used to do it the old-fashioned way, and maybe you remember this, Senator Anderson, and that is we used to issue demands to bargain when we needed to talk about things in the interim. And there's nothing in this bill that prevents that from happening. And I think that is still a legal option and one that can be utilized. So
okay,
anyway, I will step away if
thank
it's
you.
All right. Thank you.
We are just going to recess this hearing temporarily, and Joel, we'll get back to you when we come back. Then I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2744, and Senator Bates, would you please come forward?
Thank you.
easy one. Thank you,
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Bates. Good to see you.
Committee members, Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3. Looks like you guys needed a time out there, and so I'm here to give you a time out. House Bill 2744 is a companion or exact bill of a bill I introduced in the Senate, and that's only because people from Southern Oregon are so well coordinated that we both managed to drop the same bill word for word at the same time, didn't know it, so I apologize to LC for making me do the same thing twice. We decided to run House Bill 2744 as the bill, however. This bill does something very simple. It allows people who have a spouse going to a deployment overseas to take up a 2 weeks leave against the Oregon Family Leave Act at no cost to their employers. It is not an increased benefit as far as time off is concerned. It allows them to spend time with their spouse prior to deployment. And at first that may not sound important, but this was brought to us by a constituent who was not allowed to do that. And her husband was being deployed for the second, third, or fourth time. I've lost track now, as many of them have here in Oregon. And they needed to take care of some legal issues. They had to make sure the will was properly drawn up. They had to make sure that things were set for their children. And they didn't have time to do that. And they needed signatures done. And they needed things taken care of. Just from that point of view, this is a bill we should pass. The other piece of this is that these people need time together before they are shipped overseas. This is a family that will be disrupted for at least a year. We have one family in our district where the husband has now been deployed 5 times to either Iraq or Afghanistan. He has a 9-year-old daughter he has seen 10 months. That is part of his enlistment in the National Guard, and he's been deployed over and over again. He's not volunteered for it. So this is something we need to do for those families. There's no cost to employers. It comes under the Leave Act. There's no extension of time being offered. It's something we need to do to support our veterans. And we often talk about supporting our veterans, but too often we talk it and don't walk it. I've had some employers be opposed to this, and when I sat down and talked to them about it, they understood what we were trying to do, and while they had some reservations because it disrupted their work, they understood it was something that needed to be done. So I would ask you to move this forward if you possibly could today. It's a good bill. It's important to a small group of people, but ones who really do need our support.
Thank you for your testimony. And we did hear from you, Representative Esquivel, the other day, but if you had something to add, please go ahead.
No, I just wanted to be, for the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, just wanted to be here to support this concept, like I said before. And Doc Bates and I both came out of Vietnam. One day you're carrying an M16, and then 2 or 3 days later you're stepping off a curb in a peaceful surrounding, and it's quite a cultural shock, not only for you but also for your family, because you are a different person, and they do need this time to unwind.
Great, thank you. I think also a question arose at our last hearing about whether domestic partners were covered under the language of the bill, and we have clarified that they are. In fact, any time a spouse or that relationship comes up, domestic partners are also included under state law now. So,
Madam Chair, I am very proficient in showing you how to get there from here, because I followed that with Senator Prosansky over here. So
right.
We do know how to get there from now on.
Okay, very good. So thank you both for your testimony. Senator Bates, would you like to carry this on the floor?
I would look forward to doing that.
Great. Okay.
Thank you very much for being here.
And we are in a work session. Senator Manis Anderson.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2744 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Manis Anderson moves House Bill 2744 and Gross to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And is there any discussion? Okay, Pam, please call the roll.
Senator Sellers.
Aye.
Senator Prosansky.
Aye.
Senator
Manis
Anderson.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Helfer. Excused. Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Bates will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2744 and reopen the work session on House Bill 2831. Joel, please come forward.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I am Joel Rosenblatt, staff attorney with SEIU Local 503 OPEU, where I've been practicing labor law for 11 years. I was also a board agent at the NLRB for 8 years. SEIU Local 503 supports House Bill 2831A, 13 amendments. We do not support the A16 amendments. We exempted temps who work 3 months or less, but we do not support an hourly exemption that can be spaced over an entire year for longer than 3 months. And I must say, in deference to the chair's request, I've cut out one of my longest paragraphs here. And it's hard for a long-winded lawyer to be brief, but I'll try. The amendments allow but do not require that temporary employees and seasonal employees be included in a bargaining unit with other employees if they perform substantially the same work as other employees. Temporary and seasonal employees should be part of a bargaining unit if they are included in a petition before the Oregon Employment Relations Board, the ERB, with a proper showing of interest. Their inclusion would be subject to a vote of the employees sought in the petition. If the employees vote for representation or inclusion in an existing bargaining unit, collective bargaining negotiations would ensue, and the temporary employees or seasonal employees would not be guaranteed any wages or benefits. It would be a result of the negotiation process. Temporary employees could have different wages and benefits as a result of such negotiations. For example, our bargaining units with the state of Oregon have included temporary employees for the last 8 years. The temporary employees receive the same pay for the same jobs as other employees, and they receive holiday pay, but they do not receive health insurance, sick leave, or vacation. So that was all negotiated. We have a provision in the amendments to not disturb collective bargaining agreements, and we also exclude education employees that could be adversely affected by the amendments. In response to testimony by employers in the House, this bill was amended by the petitioners to, or by the unions that proposed it, to exclude temporary or seasonal workers who work for 3 months or less during a 12-month period. The intent was to allow employers to hire students or other temporary or seasonal employees for short-term jobs such as lifeguards or for leaf removal without having a union petition to represent such employees in its bargaining unit with regular employees. Temporary and seasonal workers who work for longer periods of time doing the same work as other bargaining unit members develop common interests and bonds with those bargaining unit members. They deserve representation if they desire representation. Casual employees do not deserve such representation. I'll talk about casual employees in a minute. We accept the 3-month limitation, but not hours that can have an employee working all year long on a part-time basis as a temporary employee and not be included in a bargaining unit if they so desire. We support exempting an employee who works consistently throughout a 3-month period, not longer than a 3-month period. Now, casual employee is a term used in labor relations to identify part-time employees who have irregular hours of work without continuous employment. If part-time employees work a regular number of hours over a period of time, they share a community of interest with other employees and they're included in bargaining units. The National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, has a simple test for determining casual status for the last 40 years. If an employee has worked an average of 4 or more hours a week in the quarter preceding the eligibility date for an election, the employee is included in the bargaining unit. The ERB often looks to the National Labor Relations Board for guidance. The Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, the PECBA, was modeled after the National Labor Relations Act in its structure, language, and purpose. The ERB is not required to follow the NLRB, but in this case it should, because the test I just outlined, which is in the definition of casual employee that we've added to the amendments, is objective, it's easy to apply, it gives clear guidance to employers and to unions about who is and who is not a casual employee. In the amendments to House Bill 2831, temporary employees are distinguished from casual employees because they refer to two different types of employment relationships. A temporary employee is hired for the purpose of meeting emergency, non-recurring, or short-term workload needs, but works a regular schedule. A casual employee is a part-time employee hired for any purpose who works an irregular schedule. We believe that the best way to define a casual employee is to use the NLRB standard that clearly and easily determines who is a casual employee and who is not. SEIU Local 503 urges you to adopt the temporary employee amendments to House Bill 2831, including the definitions of temporary employee and casual employee, to allow temporary and seasonal employees who so desire to have a voice in determining their wages, hours, and working conditions, especially when employers are relying more frequently on such contingent employees to get the same work done that other bargaining unit employees perform. And as I point, as Joe Schaefer from our union pointed out in the last session, Marion County, almost a third of their workers are temporary employees. And they do the same work as the other employees in the bargaining unit. So we urge you to make these changes to allow the temporary employees to join with other employees if they see a common interest in doing so.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this witness?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator George.
I want to get this casual employee thing correctly. So as I understood all your testimony, I just want to make sure I got this correctly. If you look at the definition that's in the amendments, it says an average of 4 hours per week. So in a quarter, it's basically 45 hours. If they work less than 45 hours. So if they worked all those hours in 1 week, there's no like weekly test or anything like that. It's only an average. As long as it was in the quarter, they work less than 45 hours in the quarter, they're fine.
Right, although they still have to be employed. So in other words, right. If they work 45 hours and they were no longer employed and they weren't going to be working anymore, they wouldn't be included.
But it's an average, not
it is an average.
There's no weekly test or monthly test or whatever. Okay,
that's thanks. Correct.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. I had heard the argument that this is with the Dash 16 amendments, that this would be consistent with the number of hours that are required under the PERS retirement system, and so that's why they chose 600 hours.
I thought the PERS retirement system required 6 months for eligibility.
600 hours in a calendar year.
In a calendar year, okay.
And do you have any comments on why this, again, needs to be different?
Well, I think, you know, I'm not sure why that was adopted by the legislature for PERS, but I think you're comparing apples and oranges. That PERS system is eligibility for health benefits, but we're talking about whether employees have a common interest with other employees, that the NLRB over the years has come to this test where if you work a certain amount of time that you're not casual, and we were trying to respond with the 3 months rather than the 600 hours to the summer employee, the lifeguard, which was raised by the employers in the House hearings, the leaf blower, somebody who would be brought in for a short period of time to get rid of all the leaves. And we thought that that made sense, that if somebody was coming in for a short period of time and wasn't coming back, that employee should be exempted. But if you go to 600 hours, then the 600 hours could be spaced over an entire year, and that employee may have more common interest with the other employees because they're continuing in that job over a whole year instead of working for a short period of time and then they're gone. So we think the 3 months was a concession that we made that made sense, but 600 hours doesn't make sense to us. I don't think it has anything to do with the PERS system. It has to do with how long are you there and when do you have a community of interest with other employees.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an example. Follow-up, yeah. I was just trying to think of an example of someone who works very few hours. Say, I know teaching isn't, but if you were taught swimming lessons through I don't know, the county, but you only did it a few hours a week over a long period of time, and where I would think that they should be in the bargaining unit, but I don't know if you could capture that type of person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think if they're working over a long period of time, they may have want some say in the setting of their wages, hours, and working conditions, and that's exactly the kind of person that we would like to be included if they're working over a long period of time or maybe continuously and over a number of years. But, you know, if you set a 600-hour threshold, they could be worked 599 hours a year, and then they would never be allowed in a bargaining unit, and we don't think that would be fair to that person. And I'd also like to mention that higher ed faculty work on a quarter system, which is less than 3 months, and that's why we've exempted higher ed faculty, because they could work for a quarter a year, but every year for 10 years or longer. And they would have an interest in setting their wages, hours, and working conditions because they're working there continuously. But in that case, for less than 3 months, so we exempted higher ed faculty.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I'll call Ann Hannes and Mark Rasmussen, Georgette Brown, and Jan Coleman. If the four of you would please come forward. And thank you for waiting so patiently.
Oh, no problem. Thank you, Chair Rasmus, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. AOC is concerned about 2831 for several reasons. One, we think it would make it more difficult to manage organizations and lengthen the bargaining negotiations. Temporary and seasonal workers include a wide range of different types of individuals. They range from summer recreational help to individuals filling in for family and medical leave to temporary work due to, say, a federal grant. We also think they differ substantially from regular workers because they're hired to meet emergency, non-recurring, or short-term workforce. We put forward the 600 hours, the -16 amendments, because in the A engrossed version, it does say 3 months, but it doesn't define the number of hours. So you could have someone working several hours each month and still then qualify under this under the A engrossed bill as being eligible. We also think that this could draw contract negotiations longer because of the differences between the desires of temporary and regular workers. Secondly, we are concerned about it locking in the supervisory classifications despite changing circumstances. Duties change over time, especially during these kind of circumstances where we're all grappling with how to manage our organizations, where we're having to make unfortunate substantial cuts. And this would make for a more rigid organizational structure that's less adaptable because you would not be able to deal with those changes. We also believe that it would increase costs over time. As Bill Van Vactor mentioned the other day, effective negotiators on behalf of temporary workers will seek compensation and benefit increases. And then this bill also prevents jurisdictions from hiring permanent replacements. That's sometimes a bargaining tool, although we have really not used that very frequently. I also would like to mention a little bit more about the -16 amendments that we did also take out language that would deal with the supervisory classifications because we recognize that organizational structures change as duties change. And we want to go on record as opposing the -13 and the -15 amendments. The -13 amendments, by defining casual workers as anyone working 4 hours per week, that then defines temporary workers as people working more than 4 hours per week. So we thought that it was appropriate to bring the 600 hours per week as a way to set that threshold. And then the 15 repeals the expedited bargaining. This has been an important
tool. I don't think you meant to say 600 hours per week.
600 hours, sorry. 600.
You might feel like we're working that many hours.
As it's getting into the time of the session, it feels like that. 600 hours per calendar year. Thank you very much. And then the -15 amendments repeals expedited bargaining. This has been an important tool. One of the things that we have suggested is building in a mandatory mediation period as a way to try to make sure that is used appropriately. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll hear from everybody before we open it up for questions. So whoever wants to go next. Yeah, just move the mic over there.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is Mark Rasmussen. I'm a human resource consultant with the Department of Administrative Services. And I'll give you our shortest version of the issues and concerns that we have just around one portion of the bill. And that is the definition of managerial employee as proposed. And we have had discussions with the governor's office regarding the proposed revision to managerial employee. And the governor supports the request to return to the current definition of managerial employee. That definition only applies to state government employees. It doesn't affect local jurisdictions or counties. The bill, the Angross version, proposes to amend the definition of managerial employee so that it must also supervise other employees and have the authority to take personnel actions that would affect the economic status of employees. And this revision overlaps with the definition of supervisory employees elsewhere in PECBA, which is on page 4, line 24 of the A engrossed version of the bill. This change in definition would remove a number of state employees from the management service of the state and would have a significant impact on agency operations. For example, a senior policy analyst with an agency will make decisions and recommendations regarding program direction and staffing levels associated with represented employees within agencies, and we feel that that's a conflict. We would support an amendment to maintain the current managerial employee definition, and this action would reduce the fiscal impact that we've submitted on this bill. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, and I think the other two witnesses are going to be on a specific issue, so if there are questions for these first two witnesses, why don't we take them now? Senator Moniz-Anderson.
It's the same question that I asked that Mary Bobkin would get back to me. It would be nice to know, do some jurisdictions use expedited bargaining more frequently than others? And I'd like to know for what purposes did they need to use expedited bargaining?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Moniz-Anderson, we will get back with you on that information.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm with the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I am the recently retired Yamhill County Clerk. We bring forward the election worker issue to you. This piece was a Dash 9 amendment that was incorporated into what you see now as the A engrossed bill. And we're speaking to employees that are not somebody who work a couple of months. These are people who work a matter of days, but they work in election cycles that can actually overlap, so they really don't fit the casual employee definition. I sat and figured out, and there is a possibility that some of these employees could work in like 80 hours in the total three-month period, because you have a March election, then you have a May election that abut each other, then you have a September election and a November election that abut each other. These people work about 5 days to 7 days, maybe, inserting ballots before they are mailed. Then they come back, and they can start opening and preparing the ballots for counting. They can do that on the Tuesday before the election and work through election day. Sometimes they'll work a couple days after the election doing write-ins. So you can see that they could actually work a period where they're going to get actually maybe more than 4 hours in this 12-week period, just because of the way the election cycles abut. But these are people that are recognized federally, and I have cited that in some information that is being passed out to you, that these are called election workers by the IRS, and they have stipulated to the Department of Treasury, has stipulated to IRS that they don't need to have taxes taken out, nor do they even need to get a W-2 unless these people earn more than $1,400 in a year. And we had about 30 of these people working in my county, and I think two people last year had to have W-2s because they got just over $1,400. We're talking people that, you know, just do not work regularly, but they may not fall into that casual people. And they are, for the most part, retired people that are working to get some extra money for Christmas presents, etc. If they end up being charged for union dues, it would probably be a good share of what they earn because they're working for minimum wage. So probably most of them would quit, and then we would be going out to temp agencies to get people to replace them, and temp agencies are going to cost us more money. So it's a fiscal to us.
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead.
I'm Georgette Brown. Excuse me. Chair Rosenbaum and committee members. I'm Georgette Brown. I'm the former Josephine County Clerk. I retired just this past year. And I have dealt with election workers for the past 25 years. And they are devoted people. And I've never heard anyone say that they needed to have any bargaining or anything like that. They care very much about the election process, the integrity of the election, and we would hate to lose them if they were told they had to join a union, because that we probably would lose these people and could just get people from temp agencies who had no commitment to the election system, and this would really be devastating to the whole election process.
Have you ever heard of any group of these employees trying to conduct an organizing campaign?
No, never.
Never.
So it doesn't seem too likely that regardless of this bill, that would happen.
Well, I don't know if they'd be forced to or not.
Well, they couldn't be forced to unless somebody held an organizing campaign and they voted to join a union or signed a petition where the majority of them chose to do that.
Oh, okay, because the wording we sent was a little bit...
Yeah, I mean, it's not that they would automatically be in a union.
Okay.
It's just that they're eligible for conducting an
organizing
election.
It just seems strange that we had excluded them in the A and Gross, and then that got taken out of the amendment.
Okay, any questions?
Well, Madam Chair, I understand sometimes they bring up the rubber hoses to get these people in line sometimes.
You never know.
Okay.
That man over there.
Okay. I don't think there are any other questions for you, so thanks very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, next let's call Scott Winkles, Cindy Roberts, and Mary Rowe. Then we have one more witness on this bill, and then we'll move on. Good afternoon. Thanks for coming back, and please go ahead.
For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I will not read my written testimony, which I believe is being passed out now. The League of Oregon Cities does have some concerns with this legislation, specifically the way the bill redefines supervisory employees so that the ability to perform the enumerated functions of a supervisor would not necessarily require the Employee Relations Board to conclude that that person is a supervisory employee. From the perspective of the League of Oregon Cities, that is going to have result in numerous unit clarification petitions before the ERB, but the language doesn't provide a lot of direction to ERB as to how the legislature feels they should rule. It hasn't tell them what we think a supervisor is. It creates an interesting exception in the statute. I would also like to point out two additional things on the supervisor employee language. First, the ERB has ruled that as recently as February 10th, that a sergeant in the Gervais Police Department was not truly granted supervisory authority and belonged in the bargaining unit. And I believe it was last year, the superintendent of public works in the City of Union, was not granted supervisory authority and belonged in a bargaining unit. This was someone who supervised between 2 and 6 employees, depending on the time of year, and was making significant financial decisions on the part of the county. ERB ruled that person was not a supervisory statute. So the statute does appear to be functioning as in its current form. Additionally, changing the statute is going to impact local governments differently than the state. The state has recognized the need to designate certain employees as managerial employees. But if you read the definition of managerial employee in the statute, it applies only to state employees. This is not an option to a local government. So a person who is designated as a supervisory employee, the state could conceivably file a unit clarification petition or seek to designate that employee as managerial. That is not an option recognized available to local government. And from our perspective, a library director, a superintendent of public works, a city recorder is probably what most people would consider managerial. So we believe the current statute is working now. We would believe that that language should be stricken from the bill. And there's an amendment to the -16s that would do so. Additionally, the temporary limited duration employees language in the bill is problematic to League of Oregon Cities. There are numerous instances where an employee has worked on call or to fill in for a person on medical leave. We have in one of our cities currently, we have a scenario where a city employee has to get, I believe it's dialysis once a week, and one person comes in to cover. Hopefully that condition will be resolved quickly. But this group of employees have different needs than the full-time employees. These people were hired under a temporary arrangement. We believe that the league believes that there is a threshold at which a temporary employee ought to be brought into a bargaining unit if they clearly are doing the same work. The legislature felt that 600 hours is sufficient for PERS benefits. I think that definition makes sense. That's 15 weeks of full-time employment, 30 weeks of half-time employment. So it's not a insurmountable obstacle to get. And I can't conceive of my memberships, by and large, saying that a person who hits 599 hours is going to get cut off and told to go home. That is not a practice that I think our membership would, the League of Oregon City members would do, personally. The last point on the language, the prohibition on strike replacements, there is some angst that this might make a strike more likely on the part of League of Oregon Cities, but we've done some research and we cannot find a strike in the recent history, in my lifetime of note among Oregon Cities. I think the last one was in the early 1970s in Klamath Falls. This is not an issue that impact city governments, and we do not seek to have this language altered in any way. Briefly, I would address the -15 amendments. On the House side, Representative Edwards sponsored some negotiations on this topic. The League agreed to a tentative agreement that had come out of those negotiations that apparently had subsequently fell apart. That agreement was that expedited bargaining would stay in place. Both parties could mutually agree to arbitration at any point, and there would be mediation extended on the end of it. We stand ready to support such a proposal should it be offered. We would regard ourselves as honor-bound to that agreement. And with that, I would close my testimony and look forward to questions.
Okay. We'll take all your testimony and then open it up for questions. Please go ahead.
Go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Mary Rowe. I'm Human Resources Director for Metro. Metro has several lines of businesses that don't usually come before the legislature, and one of those businesses is that we operate the Oregon Zoo. Although there are many aspects of this bill that have the potential to impact Metro, I won't repeat those arguments that have already been stated by other employers here. Instead, I want to point out the impact on Oregon Zoo, which is the number one paid tourist attraction in Oregon with over 1.6 million visitors a year. House Bill 2831 states will include temporary, now may include temporary seasonal employees in the definition of bargaining unit, and would therefore further open the door to extend labor contract provisions to seasonal employees. This could include benefits, grievances, and other bargain benefits. As written, any employee working 3 months in a 12-month period would qualify, or as proposed, 600 hours in a year. So we find the language is a moving target right now, and that's troublesome. The bill would substantially affect Metro's ability to hire seasonal employees. The zoo employs over 700 seasonal employees. When you add our parks and that, we employ over 800 seasonal employees per year. We spend over $3 million a year on seasonal and temporary employees. So if we started adding additional benefits to those that our temporary and seasonal already have to give them full benefits of all other employees, it could have up to $1 million impact on Metro. We've consistently made commitments to providing affordable and quality experiences and services to visitors and our customers. Subsequently, with additional expenses like that, Metro facilities would have to make a critical decision between diminishing visitor experience, customer service, and raising admission price and user fees, which could impact Oregon's tourism trade, or at least the number one tourism attraction for Oregon. The Oregon Zoo alone serves over 10,000 a day, many of whom are families on budgets. The peak season is the summer, but we also have various intermittent seasons, such as when we have a baby elephant born, zoo lights, et cetera. So we need that flexibility to hire people on during those seasons. Many of our seasonal and temp employees are college students or people that are retired, people that have winter jobs such as teachers, and they do like the flexibility to come work for us and do come back in that capacity repeatedly. Putting language in saying that it may include temporary employees and is an attempt to soften the bill. However, if we make it inclusive, we really don't need legislation dictating that, and I think that's where it starts opening the door rather than just leaving the situation as it is now. Metro supports its employees. We believe in living wages. We feel that we provide living wages. Some of our seasonal and temps do have contributions to health insurance benefits and all. However, we don't feel that this bill necessarily gets at further supporting living wages for workers or better wages, but that it could actually lead to more laid-off workers, unfortunately. And for that reason, we don't support the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony, Cindy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had a beautiful piece of oration all prepared for you today and have since found that some amendments have really helped us some of the problems. Cindy Robert, on behalf of the City of Medford, we have 471 employees and about 170 to 100 part-time employees. The addition in the A13s of the word may make this bill much more palatable for us, with two exceptions. Number one, the 600-hour limit may not work as well for us as it would, say, in the I-5 area. In Medford, we have beautiful weather, and our temporary employees and our seasonal employees sometimes work longer than that 600 hours. I understand that that is a number that's been used somewhere else, but we would be happy to sit down and talk about how we might amend that to better benefit our employees. Secondly, we do believe that the expedited bargaining issue was already taken care of on the House side and that some agreements were made that we were very comfortable with. Beyond that, I would like to simply thank SIEU for being so open to some changes on this bill, and thanks Senator Rosenbaum for bringing something forward that does help the employees of Oregon.
Okay, thanks for your testimony. Questions, Senator Moniz Anderson?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'd like to know from Metro and from the cities, were you okay with the A engrossed? It's just that you weren't okay with the amendments, or are you just not in favor of even the A engrossed? I wasn't clear on that.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Moniz Anderson, we are not in support of the engrossed version of the bill.
Okay.
As it stands now, I think our objections could be addressed.
Thank you.
I would concur with that. The A engrossed provides some provisions that certainly are more favorable, such as the inclusive language of May. However, there's still other provisions of the bill that we have difficulty with.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may even be for the committee. This is the third committee this week where we've had this May shall issue come up, and the committees are saying that they're interchangeable. It means the same thing. So we think it means less mandatory than shall, but we've been told that legislative council is using may in place of shall with the same emphasis.
I think that would be a question properly addressed to legislative council.
Okay.
Which we'd be happy to.
Yeah, I would request that then, because I'm getting mixed messages on the various committees as to whether shall is or may is really just a modernization of shall.
Okay, we will get an answer to that question. We are not going to move this bill today. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you all for your testimony. We have one more witness, and that is Tricia Smith. If you'd please come forward. Oh, were you on a different bill?
2021.
Oh, okay. Well, then
sorry.
We'll just move you over to that sign-up sheet. Oh, yeah. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't see you on today's list. So.
I'm sorry, Chair Rosenbaum. I was on that last
right.
panel from the
sure.
previous.
And that's great. Please go
I'm
ahead.
I'm Alex Kyler. For the record, I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. Lane County has taken a position of opposed to House Bill 2831, and I just wanted to give the members of the committee a couple perspectives. One is that the Dash 15s with the insertion or the insertion of the repeal of expedited bargaining. Expedited bargaining is a tool that Lane County has used several times, quite a bit, because it does provide us with a great deal of nimbleness that it does not otherwise is not afforded to us. An example of that is, for instance, in our last bargaining with our largest union, we did try to get a discussion into bargaining process of the drug and alcohol policy, but that was rejected by the union, so then we went to the expedited bargaining process. So it has been used. We do use it on occasion. We use it also when, for instance, if we're unable to attract a qualified pool of applicants, and then we may use that to work with the union to say, hey, we want to put into place a temporary employee or a contracted employee while we continue to seek the qualified pool of applicants that we have, or address the low payment that led to the non-attraction of the people in the first place. The final point I wanted to make with regards to previous testimony about the number of temporary employees that are utilized. Lane County, at an elections process, may go through as many as 220 temporary employees, and over the course of the year, we may use up to 700 temporary employees, fully 50% of the workforce, if you consider it based on the strictly on a unit number of employees. But that's not the same as looking at the total number of hours that those employees work. And my question, that there was a little back and forth about, well, the people are, those temporary people are able to form their own union if they so desire. I guess my question is don't they need to be employed? So could you not? Couldn't you not have a circumstance where you may have a very few number of employees speaking on behalf of a very great number of temporary employees to form such a bargaining unit? And so I don't think it goes to such sort of that sort of commonness that employees might share, because they really aren't all getting a say in the formation. And with that, I'll cease. Thank you.
Okay, great. Any questions? I don't see any, so it looks like you're off the hook. Thank you. That completes everybody we had signed up. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify today on House Bill 2831? I do not see anybody, so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2831, and we'll take this bill up again. I'm not carrying it over. We'll just post it for a future hearing. Okay, so moving right along, I think what we'll do next, is, because we actually tried to call her already, is go to House Bill 2821A, which we said we would hear after 4 o'clock. And who's representing which bill?
Yeah, he wanted to be called.
Okay, so actually, because we wanted to call the sponsor, why don't you call Representative Witt, and we, in the meantime, we can take some testimony. We have two people signed up, so why don't I call them both together, and I'll call Kate Newhall and Tricia Smith. And Jeremy, please tell us about this bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2821A engrossed prohibits an employer from requiring an employer, an employee, to use accrued vacation leave when taking family leave, provides that employer may determine the order in which accrued leave is to be used in circumstances where more than one type of accrued leave is available to employee, subject to collective bargaining agreement or other agreement between employer and employee, and the above prohibition against requiring an employee to use accrued vacation leave. Requires the employer to provide employee the employer's policy for taking family leave and the use of accrued vacation leave during a period of family leave. Requires employee to communicate to employer within a reasonable period of time prior to taking family leave the employee's intention to use accrued vacation in connection with family leave. Requires an employee to comply with all existing notice requirements related to taking family leave. The bill has no revenue impact, and we have minimal fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued. And that's it.
Great. And I see Representative Witt has joined us, and we have just explained what House Bill 2821 does. So you came in at the perfect time, and you can be our first witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, appearing today in support of House Bill 2821. This is a bill that provides employees who take a family medical leave with the option of taking eligible accrued paid time off or not. Presently, employers may mandate the use of paid vacation time. In those instances where an employee takes multiple forms of accrued paid time off under family medical leave, such as vacations and perhaps sick leave combined, House Bill 2821 reserves for employers the right to determine the order in which such multiple forms of paid leave are taken. It's a very simple bill, and it moves that option presently from the employer to the employee to determine whether or not they would choose to be exercising paid vacation. And in that regard, I would urge your committee's favorable action on the bill.
Okay, thank you for
thank
your
you.
Testimony. It sounds like you're a little out of breath, so
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Brenn
I have
here.
Been running since right after lunch.
Thank you. Are you able to stay to take some questions?
Yes, or? I am.
Okay, great. Then why don't we take the other witnesses, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2821, which, as Representative Witt and the committee administrator describes, prohibits an employer from requiring an employee to exhaust all paid accrued vacation leave prior to taking any unpaid family leave. House Bill 2821 would still allow the employer to determine which order any paid leave is the employee uses any of their paid leave, but it would also allow employees a choice if they wanted to retain some of their accrued, say, vacation leave. The Bureau of Labor and Industries participated in a work group over in the House side that was convened at the request of Representative Witt when this bill was considered in his committee. And the A engrossed version of this bill reflects the product of that work group and I believe addresses all of the concerns that were raised with the initial concept. Essentially, what the A engrossed version of the bill does is require that the employer have a conversation with the employee about accrued leave policies and vacation policies that they have prior to that, to the employee maintaining any of their, or when the employee tells them that they want to take leave and maintain some of their leave. So, in closing, the Bureau is very supportive of allowing employees this choice. If an employee wants to retain any paid vacation time, they should be allowed to make that choice and choose to take any family leave as unpaid time. And with that, happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Okay, and I think we'll take all the testimony and then take questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we are here in support of House Bill 2821. We participated in the work group on the House side on this bill, and we're very pleased that we were able to come to agreement with employer groups on how this bill should be implemented, and we think that it's a great bill, and it ought to pass. And I'll say one more thing that hasn't been said. We've had many years of experience with family leave, from an early pregnancy leave through family medical leave, and through that process we recognized what a good policy it is to allow employees the ability to take care of a sick child or parent, family member in an emergency or a time of need. Vacation leave is compensation. It is a form of compensation like wages. And when vacation leave can be, the use of vacation leave can be mandated by an employer, that's akin to an employer mandating how you spend your paycheck. Many employees have a particular plan for a vacation that may involve a surgery or some very important family issue, and to require them to use that vacation leave on something unexpected like the illness of a child may really cause a serious complication in the lives of those employees, and we believe that it steps beyond the bounds of appropriate employer authority. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for your testimony. Any questions? I guess not. Okay. Thank you all for being here. We have one more witness, and that's Mike Sullivan. And please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, for allowing me to make testimony today. And committee members, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. Talking with Vice President Greg Pellison from AWPPW, he told me although the collective agreements that AWPPW enters into protects the employees from having to take vacation with family leave, but there have been ongoing problems. The intent of the law was that family leave was a benefit and it could not be replaced by another benefit. Vacation is considered a benefit. I will cite one example of the problems that have occurred with AWPPW's Local 78. Before the current contract language, the Human Resources Director would go so far as to make the employees take 6 weeks vacation with their family leave to take care of a family member who was sick. The current contract language offers some improvement, but the employer is still applying the family leave where they think it is a qualifying event and where it isn't. Plainly speaking, the employer is dictating to the employee when and how the employer can take family leave. This is a big issue for these employees, and they're trying to dodge the employer's family leave bullet. Some of these employees have chosen to call in sick rather than take vacation, and not when the employers think that they should take the family leave. In closing, Chair Rosenbaum and committee members, AWPPW is in full support of House Bill 8121 because of the belief the bill will close the loophole on what the intent of the family leave law was. I will now try and answer any questions that you or the committee would have of me, Madam Chair.
Any questions?
I think, Madam Chair, he has to
Senator
say 2821.
Oh, I hit it backwards. I'm sorry. It's been a long day. This is the third committee I've been to since 3 o'clock.
Yep, it's a busy time. Okay, I don't see any questions, so thank you very much for your testimony. We do have written testimony from Associated Oregon Industries. Did you wish to testify? Both of you. Okay, please come forward. Hey,
I'm hoping that lightning doesn't strike both of us here. I'm Mary Batkin with AFSCME Council 75, and I want to stand in favor of this bill. Our folks who work in corrections have had no end of problems with sort of unilateral decisions about how their family leave should be used. Probably the worst case was one where one of our officers was on deployment and came back and found out that his family leave had been evaporated while he was gone. We've resolved most of those issues, but it has not been without some consternation. And we really had to bring in not only Secretary Avakian, but also members of the military department to sort of sort this stuff out. And so we really need to pass the bill to just make it very clear about what order and who gets to pick what leave you're using when you're gone. And as I said, there have been many challenges over the years associated with workers' comp and military leave and other issues around the use of family leave. And I think this bill just clarifies the usage and who gets to decide which is being used when, or in some cases, when an employee just wants to take time off with no pay at all. And if that is possible for the employer to give them, then they should absolutely be allowed to utilize unpaid leave if that's for their choice. And we think that works well, and this bill just clarifies the order in which and who gets to decide. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing AOI, giving the other point of view on this particular issue. And I don't like doing that to my good friend, Representative Witt, but AOI does not support House Bill 2821. It's been a particularly busy couple of years in family leave for employers. If you attended any employment seminar over the last 18 months, they were talking about the changes made by the 2007 legislature as well as the federal changes that were put into play earlier this year. In the 2007 changes implemented by the legislature, you now talked about expanding family leave to include grandkids and grandparents. We mandated that employers have to pay employees accrued sick leave regardless of what the employer policy was at the time. And you also talked about divorcing workers' comp leave from family leave. So some very significant changes. And then the DOL comes in and dumps a truckload of changes on employers earlier this year. And I passed out to you, the Commissioner Avakian was good enough to start the process of reconciling federal and state differences in our respective family leave laws. And this sheet that I handed out to you is 15 pages just in the federal changes and how federal changes are separate from current state law. And that's just with regard to the changes that were made federally. It doesn't incorporate all the differences there are between the federal FEMLA and OFLA. So as a policy, AOI does not support... We support keeping the laws the same, to the extent that we can, and we usually feel that any differences between the two laws, because employers have to track leaves under both and track the differences between both, we're getting to the point now where we have a pretty jaundiced view of separation between state family leave law and federal family leave law. We like to keep those consistent. It is a hardship on employers when you do have, under Oregon law, you can get in excess of 12 weeks, a lot of times 24, and in rare instances 36 weeks. But when that amount of leave is taken and then someone wants to come back and take 2 or 3 weeks of vacation, it is a hardship. So for those reasons, we'd like to see the law and the flexibility as is, and would not support this change.
Thank you for your testimony. And I know there have been references to a work group on the House side. Did you participate in that, JL?
I did not. And to be honest, I'm not sure how productive it would have been to have an opponent. I probably would have disrupted proceedings as opposed to helping them along. So I did not take part, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any other questions for these witnesses?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator George.
Joe, when you look at other states, are other states doing this thing where they're bifurcating these two things so you have these two completely separate regulatory criteria that employers have to find? Are other states trying to merge these things so that there's one, basically that their state law mirrors their federal law, so you don't have employers chase? I mean, that's going to, I know, it doubles a lot of my HR problems, mm-hmm. personally. Are you seeing any other states trying to make these things consistent? I know we do that in a lot of other areas of law.
Yeah. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, I don't have a pat answer for you, but obviously there are some states that choose to remain consistent and some that don't. The biggest change, obviously, between Oregon law and federal law is that our employee threshold goes down to 25, where the federal threshold is 50. So you do talk about the imposition of family leave rules on a segment of employer between 25 and 49 that does not exist under federal law.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. And is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2821? Okay. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2821. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2821, open a work session on House Bill 2821, and we're carrying this bill over to our next scheduled hearing, which is Wednesday. I don't know what the date is, but
27th.
Wednesday the 27th, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2821. Thank you. Okay, now it looks like we're moving on to workers' comp, and we'll go back up to the top of our agenda, which is, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3345. Chairman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3345A engrossed modifies the circumstances under which attorney fees may be awarded in workers' compensation claims, requires adjusting the amount of certain attorney fees based on increase in average weekly wage as determined in workers' compensation law. It establishes parameters for modifying attorney fees. It allows Department of Consumer and Business Services to impose penalty and awards of attorney fees for late payment of amounts due under disputed claim settlement. Sunsets the increase in attorney fee imposed for unreasonable delay in payment of compensation or acceptance of or denial of claim on January 2, 2014. It requires the Management Labor Advisory Committee to review effects of certain provisions of measure and report to the Legislative Assembly by January 1, 2013. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued. And this bill was approved by the MLAC committee, has the support of the MLAC committee, I believe. And they're nodding.
Okay. That's it. Okay, we have four witnesses and four chairs, so why don't you all come up together, Chris Moore, Chris Davey, Drew Hagedorn, and Jennifer Flood. Good afternoon. Thanks for waiting so patiently.
And in whatever order you want to go, please go ahead.
I think I'll go first. Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney from Eugene. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, Oregon Workers' Comp Attorneys, and my law firm, Maligon Moore & Jensen. HB 3345 is a, first I want to say it's a consensus bill. The good people to my right and one person who's not here from Liberty Northwest and the claimants bar came to agreement on some attorney fee issues. We presented that to the Management Labor Advisory Committee and they agreed to pass the bill out and send it over here to the legislature. I'm happy to talk specifics if there are any questions. Otherwise, I'd just like to cover this as briefly as possible with some generalities. What this bill does is to plug some holes that currently exist in our law so that injured workers are able to have attorneys get paid to represent them when the attorneys prevail on, I'm going to say, two or three issues. There are some areas of litigation that attorney fees are capped. Those caps have been increased. The caps are still fairly low. We have an escalator clause built in to the statute. It will track the state's average weekly wage, which a great many other things in the workers' comp section of the revised statutes track. And what this bill, I think, really is intended to do is to make sure that when attorneys do represent injured workers and they do prevail, that they're able to get paid and that injured workers are therefore able to get representation on those specific issues. And as I say, I don't want to try to bore you with the minutiae of the bill, but I'm happy to do so if you want.
Okay, I think we can do that in questions at the end if we need more information.
One other thing. The sunset provision was initially put in. It was taken out in the amendments. There is no sunset. We were told there are some problems with legislative counsel, and what Management Labor Advisory folks agreed to or asked us to do is to take that out and put a study in. So that's
right.
The substitute.
Thanks for that correction. We'll correct that in the staff measure summary. Okay, whoever wants to go next.
Good afternoon, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Drew Hagedorn for the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. The OSIA is a statewide association of organizations, both public and private, self-insured for workers' compensation purposes. We work together with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and the other stakeholders, Liberty Northwest and Save Corporation, in negotiations on this bill. The A and Gross version accurately reflects the agreement that we struck, and we're supportive of this bill. We urge you to approve it.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. I was surprised to learn that I had signed up to testify. That does not.
You have friends.
But that does not diminish Safe's support for this bill. It's important to us that workers have appropriate access to effective legal representation, and we participated on what was essentially our own work group before the legislature convened this year to work out the details of this bill, and we fully support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And last but not least,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Flood. I'm the Ombudsman for Injured Workers with Department of Consumer and Business Services. Again, I am here today to support 3345. I believe it will improve access to injured workers to legal representation. And every month my office does receive inquiries from workers who are struggling within our system. And this bill will help in a few of those areas in accessing representation, whereas currently when they're faced with those challenges, it's difficult for them to retain an attorney to do those services for no fee. They're just faced with just letting the issue completely go or trying to represent themselves through our system, which can be difficult. I believe House Bill 3345 does give some teeth to encouraging timely payment of benefits and settlements and timely claim processing, and I believe it's not only good for workers, but that it's good for employers and the entire workers' compensation system. I encourage you to support 3345.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel?
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I typically don't like escalator clauses in statute because it takes the power away from the legislature. So real quickly, if you could, just for me, explain to me why you use the average weekly wage to find an ORS 656-211, just so I have some background.
What we're looking at, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator George, what we're looking at in this bill is there's a very specific area of litigation. Typically, it's in front of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under present law, there's a maximum attorney fee with a fairly small escape clause. The maximum attorney's fee is $2,000. That would include representation from bringing an initial complaint to a full-blown contested case hearing to an appeal to the Court of Appeals. And that's... It's very difficult to come back session after session to ask for fairly modest increases to keep it going, just to keep that moving along to deal with the realities of the cost of practice. What happens if we don't increase it is that we end up that people end up not taking on those cases. They simply stop representing people there because it's just not cost effective. The perfect example of that is one of the other pieces of a capped attorney's fee in this that we've changed the cap on, put an escalator clause on, and that's for attorney's fees for representation under ORS 656.308, which is a multiple employer case without a order designating paying agent. That, under present law, is $1,000, and it has remained at $1,000 since 1995. And what we would like to do is to avoid having to invest a significant amount of effort on the part of a large group of people coming in front of Management Labor Advisory Committee first and then bringing it over to the legislature. The escalator clause, as I say, is 3-5% depending on the change in the average weekly wage. If there's a policy change, that obviously has to be brought ultimately to the legislature if we're going to make that policy change, and I think we would all agree that's where we would have to go with that to change policy on it.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thank you all for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3345 and open a work session on House Bill 3345.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3345 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer moves House Bill 3345, A and Gross, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay, Pam, would you please call the roll?
Senator George.
Aye.
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 Chair
Rosenbaum. Aye. And Senator Przanski is excused, and the motion carries, and the chair will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3345 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2705.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2705A engrossed modifies the circumstances that require insurer or self-insured employer to contact injured worker for evaluation of eligibility for vocational assistance. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement issued. And that's it.
Thank you, Jeremy. And we've got two witnesses, Drew Hagedorn and Susan LaVier, please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, committee members, Drew Hagedorn again for the Oregon Self-Insurers Association, here today testifying in support of House Bill 2705. This is legislation seeking to address instances where vocational eligibility evaluations are unnecessarily required. The bill comes to you with the unanimous support of the MLAC, Management Labor Advisory Committee, as well as the Oregon House of Representatives. I'm going to turn now, Madam Chair, to Susan LaVier, the co-chair of our legislative committee, who's going to explain the elements of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Susan Lavier, the co-chair of OSI Legislative Committee. The purpose of this bill is currently insured, self-insured employers are required to do vocational eligibility determinations if a worker has not actually returned to the job and injury and does not take in consideration the reason they may not have returned, although they may have a regular work release. Some may have moved, they may have retired. In some cases, they even have passed away. And at this point, vocational eligibility evaluations are between $400 and $800, and they have a requirement to perform these needlessly when a worker has a regular work release from their physician. So we're trying to get those two requirements in line with each other so that if a worker has been released to return to their job injury, that they are not required to actually perform voc eligibility. But with understanding that, there was some concern for the department of not having workers understand that they have the right to request it. They feel like they would like to have their voc eligibility reviewed, and we've actually been agreed to work with the department to put some language on the notice of closure to let them know they do have that right to request it if need be.
Okay, thanks, and I apologize for mispronouncing your name twice.
Everyone does.
So any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2705 and open a work session on House Bill 2705. Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2705A, engrossed, be moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2705A, engrossed, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Pam, please call the roll.
Senator George.
Aye.
Bumsky.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair
Rosenbaum. Aye. Motion carries. And a volunteer would be great to carry this bill on the floor.
Sure.
Senator Telfer will carry the bill. Okay, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2705 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2707A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2707A, engrossed, requires injured worker to provide within 60 days of receipt of request verifiable documentation of wages received from all subject employers of injured worker to establish eligibility for supplemental temporary disability benefits. It instructs the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt rules for payment and reimbursement of supplemental temporary disability benefits. There's no revenue impact and there's no fiscal impact. We also have a -A3 amendment, which you received with the with your packet. The -A3 amendment would change the time in which the worker must provide documentation to within 60 days of the date a request for documentation was mailed, instead of from the time it was received. Both the original bill and the amendment have the approval of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and we have no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. We have statements for both of those on the -A3 amendment.
Senator Montes Anderson, are you missing a
I'm just missing summary? A summary sheet.
Why don't we grab the one from Senator Przanski's place and we'll give it to you and we can get him.
The amendment?
The summary sheet.
The summary.
And the amendment, the dash
attached to it.
Or maybe we have another
dash
copy
three.
Of it. Pam, is there another copy over there?
Here, you take one.
I'm just seeing if I put it in another bill.
We'll give you this one for now. Okay, and we've got two witnesses signed up to testify, so I'll call them both, Drew Hagedorn and Susan Lavier.
Lavier.
Third time's the charm.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Ian Drew Hagedorn for the Oregon Self Insurance Association here today in support of House Bill 2707, engrossed along with the -3 amendments. The -3 amendments, as Jeremy indicated, were vetted by the Management Labor Advisory Committee and unanimously approved. The Oregon House also unanimously approved the engrossed version of the bill. I'll turn to Susan again to have her explain the bill and also the reason behind the -3 amendment.
Yes, again, Susan LaVier with the Co-Chair OSI Legislative Committee. The reason for the amendments initially was just basically to determine a clear defining line from when the actual start date for the 60 days runs. Currently, the way the supplemental disability benefits rules are processed, there was no requirement or no end date for the worker to provide that information, and we needed to have some kind of basically an incentive to get the information to us so that we can correctly process the benefits in a timely manner. And so this actually, the date of mailing gave a more definable line and consistent with other aspects of the statute. And the other issue that we are trying to work with, we had many issues trying to evolve and work through this process. The supplemental disability benefits have been intertwined with time loss benefits throughout the process of since they've implemented those benefits. And we're trying to figure out ways to actually work with the department and try to see if there are some points where workers who may have had a second job at the time that they were injured no longer had that job at aggravation, but they were still receiving reimbursement for those wages. We're trying to work through that process, and therefore we put the language in to try to work with the department and try to make this more into a reimbursement for those workers to be reimbursed if they're actually losing income. So that's what that those amendments, as far as reviewing, or not the amendments, but the part of the bill that talks about working with the department to implement rules for the reimbursement of these benefits.
Okay. Thank you both for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2707? Okay. Department is here, I think, just to let us know that they're okay with this bill. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2707 and open a work session on House Bill 2707. And we do have an amendment, Senator Thompson.
Chair, I move the dash A3 to dated May 11th, 2009. To House Bill 2707A.
And Senator Telfer has moved the dash A3 amendment to House Bill 2707. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, amendment is adopted. Senator Telfer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2707 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2707A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Pam, please call the roll.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Brzozinski.
Excused.
Senator
Aye.
Vice Chair Telfer.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. You have a volunteer, Senator George?
I guess so.
Okay. You can't leave. Senator George will carry the bill. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2707. And members, if you can hang in here just for a little while longer.
One more.
We have one more bill. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2907.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2907 prohibits contracting agency from entering into an agreement with another state in which the contracting agency agrees that contractor may pay less than the prevailing wage rate under the terms for the public works contract. Declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. And that's the bill.
Looks like we have no one who is here to talk about it.
We contacted Representative Holvey's office. He was a sponsor of the bill,
like,
and he said he was bringing a written testimony.
Oh, we have written testimony.
Here. We have a pass out.
Okay.
And I might add on that the vote in the House was 59 in favor and one excused.
Okay. So, members, is there anyone here who'd like to testify on House Bill 2907? No. I see we do have Representative Holvey's testimony.
Might as well read it into the record.
So, why don't I read it? Okay. Chair Rosenbaum and Senate Commerce and Workforce Development Committee, the bill simply clarifies that contracting agencies cannot enter into agreements with adjoining states which pay less than the Oregon prevailing wage on public projects or the portion of a public project that is within the state of Oregon. As an example, on a bridge crossing state boundary lines, current statute may allow an agreement between states to pay less than Oregon's prevailing wage rate. This bill would be
consistent with other ORS 279C provisions, making sure workers are not paid less. I urge your support and your due pass recommendation on House Bill 2907.
And Madam Chair, I might add in the background of the SMS, there was one incident with an interstate agreement between ODOT and Idaho's Transportation Department that would have paid less than Oregon's prevailing wages for work performed wholly within Oregon.
But did they?
What's that?
Did they?
I was wondering if they did pay less than prevailing wages. It says they could have, but I was wondering if they did when you said...
That would have paid less than Oregon's prevailing wage.
Okay. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2907 and open a work session on House Bill 2907.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2907 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Senator Telfer moves House Bill 2907 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator George.
Okay, I can only think of a few isolated situations that this bill would be applicable, which would include bridges. I can't think of any others. And I guess I want to make it clear that I don't really want to tell Idaho how to run their business. And so the way I'm reading this bill is that this applies to work done in Oregon. That's it.
Correct.
So I'm fine with that. I'm trying to figure out how this works. And I wish somebody would have been here to explain this, but that's fine. But
that's my interpretation.
As long as I understand that this is actually work done in Oregon on an Oregon project, I guess I don't have a problem with
that. And I think the record that we have made today is clear that that is the intent of the bill, as well as we can make that clear on the floor.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any further discussion? Pam, please call the roll.
Senator George.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries. And we need a carrier for this bill. Senator Montes Anderson will carry. And that completes our agenda. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2907. Members, 5 minutes to 5, and we are adjourned.
Nice job.
Oh, I thought.